I can still remember the first time my mother was disappointed in me. I was a wonderful child, a golden child, some would say. My mom's favorite by far. She's away visiting family, so you can't look over there to see if she's nodding her head or not. You'll have to take my word for it. But when I was, 11, 12, 13, I started going to work for my father in the summers, mostly to get away, so my mom had some peace and quiet. But my father was an architect. He had his own firm with a couple partners, and they had their offices on Queens Boulevard in Kew Garden in Queens, New York, right across from the courthouse, and I would go to work for my dad, and my job was to do whatever they all told me to do, all the architects working in the firm there. Mostly it was copying giant blueprints onto Mylar paper in a machine that I'm sure the chemicals gave me brain damage. And it was just, it was fun. I was working, but it was a rough around the edges group of guys. And I spent my day in that environment, and it affected me as a young boy. And I remember where it really became clear and where my mom was first and probably the only time ever disappointed in me. I was come home from work. I got myself, I think, a bowl of ice cream, brought it to the living room. I was going to watch some TV and eat some ice cream. I put it on the coffee table for just a minute and then went back to the kitchen to get my glass of milk, because that's how we snacked. Big glass of whole milk, big bowl of ice cream. And I come back in the living room and there's my dog licking my bowl of ice cream. And I said, "I am going to beat the bleep, 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 bleep out of you." Yep. And my mom said, "Anders." She was mortified that what had just come out of my mouth. And I said, "Oh, I know, I'm sorry. It's just, I immediately said, it's work, it's," I was like 12. And I'm like, "It's work and the stress of work. And all the people there, that's how they talk," and they did, but it was no excuse. And while it was an excuse, it was still true that I was being affected by that environment I worked in. And the truth is, we all are. We work in places and in situations and around people and in cultures, corporate cultures or whatever culture, school cultures, where the people around us, they're not worried about following God. The companies you work for, the schools you go to, the businesses you're in, they're not concerned about working for God. Their bottom line is not loving God and loving others. And that culture seeps into us, and it becomes a battle. And either we give into it and we feel miserable for giving into it and guilty, or we resist it and we just feel miserable all the time because it's like, "Oh, this oppressive place I'm working." Either way, it begins to ruin us and robs our joy, and we become anxious and we don't thrive. Today, I want to tackle, this is our last question in this series. How can we keep work from ruining us? Before we dive into that question, let's do just a quick review of the last few weeks. And here's what we've said. Quick review. We were created to be like God, and we're introduced to God in Genesis 1. God is what? God is someone who works and creates and brings order. And we were created to be like him, so we were created to work. We learned that work is worship. Not just the way you do it, doing it in a godly, Jesus-like way is worship, but no, the very work itself is an act of worship. Whether it's making spreadsheets or folding bed sheets, the act of doing the work is an act of worship, because you're doing something that brings order and is creative, and that is what God is like, and so it's a reflection of God's character in this world. And we talked about Jesus spent most of his life walking this planet as a carpenter working, and so there must be, I don't know what to conclude other than there must be value to the actual work itself. The actual work is worship, as well as the way we do it. And then, week 3, we talked about how work is broken, obviously. Work was supposed to be done in cooperation, in relationship, but sin has ruined that. And that's why there's constant power struggles in work, constant abuse and deceit and injustice. No matter what system there is, none of them get rid of that, whether it's capitalism, free market, socialism, communism. No economic or political system can overcome what's broken about work, sin, inside you and me, that self-centeredness. So we should stop being surprised by the fact that no system gets rid of all that. And those of us who love God should begin to do the only effective thing, which is that thing effective to change that, which is to let God change the way you and I work. So then we talked last week about how work is a shared calling that is expressed in unique individual assignments. Last week, we tried to draw that line between a calling we all have and assignments that each of us as individuals have. And those assignments and those roles that you and I serve in life, they will change from time to time. They certainly will change as you go through life. Those of you who are students now, you won't be students forever. Soon you'll be doing other things and maybe in a career. And those of you who are in one career right now, that assignment will most likely change at some point, or the work itself will change. It's always changing. But what we said is this: even though that changes, God's calling needs to be what comes first and your assignment follows. And God's calling needs to be what leads you into the assignments you take and what shapes how you engage in those assignments. Does that make sense? That was last week. And then part of last week is that calling that we all share in common is the calling to love God and love others, which means that work is an expression of love. Our shared call to love God and love others means that work, where you spend most of your time probably, right, is one of the main ways you're going to love God and love others. You're loving your family by helping provide. You're loving your coworkers by being a good coworker. You're loving your clients and those you work for, the people you serve, by doing excellent work. That's part of our calling. And all of that is wonderful and great. And we work in these real places, though, that are full of real challenges that make it really hard to do that, to live out that calling. And even if we don't engage in the bad behaviors, it can make us lose our love and stop living up to that calling. How do we keep from being ruined by the work and the work context that we find ourselves in? I want to approach this by talking about Daniel's story. You all remember Daniel from the Old Testament? A lot of us know about Daniel in the lion's den. Well, that's the end of the story. Let's go to the beginning of Daniel's story. Daniel worked, think about this. Daniel worked in government, in politics, for over 60 years at top levels, at nation-leading levels, through multiple different administrations, and yet Daniel managed to thrive and not be ruined by work. Can you imagine working 60 years in the government and not being ruined by that work? That's a miracle right there. And maybe we can learn something by just looking at Daniel's life through this lens of work and how not to be ruined by work and not have it rob us from fulfilling God's calling in it, but instead be able to actually thrive in work. So I want to kind of go through Daniel's story, imagining it from a little bit of a modern context. So Daniel was one of the best and brightest as a young man in a government that had been very godly at one point, but had begun to lose its way. And that government was taken over by another government and replaced. And this new government didn't even pretend to be godly or have godly values. He was forced to relocate. He was forced to start kind of at the bottom and reapply and go through all the training to see where he might fit in this new government. So he's doing well in a sort of godly place, forced to change, new place, completely godless, and he has to start kind of at the bottom again. And as he enters this new work assignment, new work environment, and it's much worse than that, the reality is he's an Israelite. Israel got overrun by another kingdom. He's taken as a captive to live in this other place, and he has to work for them. And then in that place, though, as a captive, in this new work assignment, it says in Daniel 1:8, right at the beginning, Daniel resolved not to defile himself. That didn't just mean, oh, I'm not going to do naughty things. Daniel resolved he would not let anything cause him to fall short of loving God and loving others. That's Daniel's resolution right here. I'm not going to let anything get in and disintegrate me and disintegrate my faith in God. I'm going to keep my faith planted in God and live my life, God in every part of it, faith in God in every part of it. And right away, they put Daniel into a training program that required him to do some things that went against what God had commanded Daniel to do and what God expected of his people. And so Daniel had to make a choice. Do I go along or do I reject? Do I revolt? What do I do? And he called his manager in and he proposed a solution. He said, here, let me just propose this, because what you're asking me to do It violates my relationship with God. And I won't do that to my God. But how about you let me train in a way that doesn't violate my faith in God for 10 days and just see what the results are. See how I'm doing. And the manager agrees, they do it. And at the end of the 10 days, Daniel far excels everyone else of all the people in he's training with, beyond everyone else. And he ends up getting a place working for the king slash president directly because he stayed faithful to God and set a new standard for how to train people by being godly. Now, Daniel could have told himself, I have no choice in this situation. I have to comply. After all, he's a captive, really, not an employee. And even if he were an employee, there were no HR departments back then, and disobedience would have meant death. They took firing literally back in those days. But Daniel refused to divide himself into different lesser Daniels, a work Daniel, a family Daniel, a friends in my neighborhood, go hang out Daniel, a worshiping at church Daniel. He chose to be the same person wherever he went, whatever he was doing. He was a man who obeyed God's calling. And so Daniel became well known as a godly man, a man of prayer, a man of wisdom, a man who wasn't afraid to speak the truth, no matter what it would cost him. So at one point, as Daniel, now he's a little bit older, he's in middle age, and the king, the president, has this sign that's revealed to him, and he doesn't know what to think of it, and so he asked Daniel to come in and help him understand it. All the other people, all his other advisors are telling him, no, you're a great king, everything's good, this can't be about you, this sign. And Daniel comes in, and he's like, yeah, I'm happy to help, what can I do? And the king slash president tells him, here's what the sign was, and Daniel is heartbroken because he immediately recognizes this is God speaking to this king, president, telling him that he's about to humble him. And Daniel has a choice there. He's, you know, you're in the middle of your life. Things are going well. You don't want to rock the boat. And to give bad news to a king or president could mess you up. But Daniel speaks the truth to him, even though it broke his heart to tell him. And he boldly told this president king, no, God's going to humble you in some horrific ways that you're going to go through. He was honest with that king, boldly honest. Can you imagine loving your boss enough to go into work this week and maybe something's happening? Can you imagine being bold enough and loving them enough to tell them whatever God asks you to say to them? Daniel was, because he wouldn't cut out this part of my life from that part of my life. And over time, through Daniel, that king, president, went through this humbling, and at the end of it, came through it and became someone who praised and honored God for who God is. Years later, that president king died, and his son took over the government, and his son was the worst, the absolute worst. And God sent him a sign too. And at this point, Daniel's now an old man, and the son calls for Daniel to be brought in because he wants Daniel to tell him everything's going to be okay. And he says, I'll give you riches and fame. I'll give you a better office. I'll give you a bonus. I'll give you a better salary, all that stuff. Whatever you want, just, you know, tell me I'm okay here. And Daniel rejects all of it, says, I don't want any of that stuff. Money was never what motivated him. It was never his why for anything he had done. And instead, Daniel says, you keep all that stuff. I'll tell you what God's saying to you. And then Daniel told him how he had been unfaithful and rejected God and how God would now treat him, that God's rejecting him, and he would suffer the consequences. And that very night, that kingdom went through a hostile takeover. Another empire swept in. That king ended up dead at the end of the night. And now a new government had taken over. And new government means new people in charge, new president, new king, new emperor. And you all know what happens whenever there's a shakeup in a work environment. Everyone's now trying to figure out, where do I fit? Am I going to get fired? Am I going to be let go? What's going to happen to me? There's a whole new pecking order. Who's in charge? Everybody's worrying about it. And Daniel, once again, old Daniel now, thrives because he continues to be faithful to God no matter what, to serve God's calling no matter what. And in fact, the king was so impressed with Daniel that he was about to give him control of the entire empire and let Daniel just run the whole thing. And that made a lot of powerful people upset. And they went then had it out for Daniel, and they decided, we're going to go after him. And so at this, Daniel 6:4, says, the administrators and the governors tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct in government affairs. They went through his browser history. They went through his credit card statements. They went through everything. But they were unable to find anything on him. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. That's 60 years in government work. 60 years in government work through different administrations who didn't even care about God. It would have been so easy to go with the flow. 60 years, and it's not just that he hasn't been untrustworthy or done something evil. He's been completely faithful and hasn't neglected anything in every bit of work he's done. He's done it as an act of worship to God, as a way of being like God, as a way of fulfilling God's calling to love God and love others. And so finally, these people who are trying to get Daniel, they say, we're never going to find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God. If someone were to go through your working for the last 60 days, would the only thing they could hold against you be your relationship with God and your faithfulness to God? What was it that enabled Daniel to go 60 years plus in these godless governments and be faithful to God, even though he was at top level positions where everyone knows you got to compromise to get those, right? And not be ruined by his work. Here's a clue to what enabled him to do that. It's what got him thrown into a lion's den. So these governors and these administrators, they want to get Daniel out of the way, and they figure the best way to do it is to put some kind of wedge between Daniel and the king. And the only way to put a wedge between Daniel and the king is to make the king try and put himself above God, because they know Daniel has integrity and he's going to serve God no matter what. So all they have to do is appeal to the king's ego. It works every time. Any leader, any one of us, just appeal to our egos and we fall. So they go into this king / president and they say to him, you know, you're a wonderful king, president, and wouldn't it be great if we declared that for 30 days, everyone had to pray to you because you're so good and so just kind to everyone, and you're the one everyone should pray to. So for 30 days, people can only pray to you. They can't pray to any other god or any other person. And if they do, we'll throw them in the lion's den. Teach them a lesson so everybody knows you're really the one in charge here. And this king president says, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Let's go with that. Everyone has to pray to me 30 days. And so the rule is enacted. Daniel hears about this new policy and immediately goes home and violates it. Immediately goes home, gets in front of his window, and then prays. Not in a broom closet, right in front of the window where anyone passing by could see him. See, Daniel's enemies attacked the one thing they knew was making him so effective and make him thriving, able to thrive at work. The one thing that enabled him to transition from administration to administration and always rise to the top without being compromised by any of the nonsense around him. The thing that enabled him to speak honestly when others lied, to be just when others were malicious. And that thing was Daniel's integrity. They knew they could count on Daniel's faith no matter what. Daniel would show faith in God no matter what. No matter where you cut him open, you're going to find faith in God. Daniel's faith was fully integrated into his entire life. It didn't fall apart when he was offered wealth. It didn't fall apart when his job or even his life was on the line. It hadn't fallen apart when he is young and idealistic and starting out. It didn't fall apart when he was in midlife and trying to keep job security. And it hadn't fallen apart when he was an old man and probably just wanted to retire. Daniel's faith was fully integrated into everything he did. He was a man of integrity. And now, when I say the word integrity, your ears are hearing integrity, but your mind might be thinking honesty. And honesty is part of integrity, but that's not what integrity fully is. Integrity is more like this. If I were to hand you a stack of $100 bills, you'd get excited, right? No? Okay. $100 bills. Now you're excited. Then you start to thumb through and you realize it's only the top and bottom ones, the outer ones that are actually $100 bills. The inside, it's $1 bills. How do you feel now? I mean, it's nice. Someone handed you a stack of ones and a couple hundreds, but now you feel less good. Now imagine you keep thumbing through and you find out after a couple of ones, it's all just scrap paper. now you're angry at me for giving you $202, but you're angry and feel jaded because that stack of $100 bills, what did it lack? It lacked integrity. It wasn't the same all the way through. Where you split the deck of $100 bills, you could get something different. You could get just trash. Christina and I like watching the Great British Baking Show. And sometimes the bakers mess up and they don't get their ingredients right or they don't mix them fully enough and they have a bad bake. And the judges, you see their face, they take a bite of something and they get curdled egg or something and they make that sour face like, what in the world is this? This is a bad bake. It lacked integrity. Or it's they take a piece out of the cake and they bite it, but there's no flavor in their piece of cake because they didn't blend it enough to get all the flavors through. The cake lacked integrity. Where you sliced it, you might get something different. When your beliefs and character, though, are fully blended into your entire life, fully baked all the way through, that's when you have integrity. When that faith in God comes out no matter where you are, no matter where you're cut, no matter what's happening, we take a slice out of your life, we see faith in God. We see it being shaped and flavored by your faith in God. Your marriage, shaped and flavored by your faith in God. Your work, your relationship with your coworkers, shaped and flavored by your faith and trust in God. Your relationship to your boss or the bigger company or to the leaders of the nation or to your neighbor. Cut into those slices of your life, and to be in, have integrity means wherever you cut, it's gonna be flavored and shaped by faith in God and commitment to God's call to love God and love others. And a fully integrated life of faith is the only way you will ever thrive at work and school. But how do you get your faith to be fully blended into your life, to be fully baked into your life? How do we get God's character and calling fully baked in all the way, integrated all the way in? Well, I just encourage you to go home today and spend time reading Daniel. Read those first several chapters of the book of Daniel and see his life and what it was that enabled him. This morning, I wanna just focus on one thing that God's put on my heart. And it's something that always hits in my heart, and I'm never sure how much to talk about it or what to say and where to fit it in with all the other things we have to talk about. But this morning, here's the one thing. If we go back to the first message of this series, you remember the invitation that Jesus gave us from Matthew chapter 11? Jesus said, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am humble, gentle, and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." And we said Jesus' invitation there is not to an all-expenses-paid vacation to get away for a little while, and it isn't to escape to heaven to get away for eternity. It was to take on his way of working, his rhythm of life, his yoke, and learn this new way of approaching work in partnership with God, letting it be modeled and shaped by God. And in that, to find rest. The Bible talks a lot about Sabbath rest. Jesus said it was made for us, a gift for us. And one of the main things that are keeping you and I from having fully integrated faith that enables us to thrive at work and not be ruined by our work is that God rested and we don't. God Sabbathed and we don't. Many of us grew up in a time where Sabbath was taught and enforced legalistically. Where Sabbath was defined by what you don't do. You don't go to movies on Sunday, you don't watch TV, whatever, you don't play games, you don't do this. It was defined by what you don't do. That legalistic approach to Sabbath was unhelpful, unhealthy, and it needed to go. But instead of replacing it with this healthy call to Sabbath that God gives us, many of us just got rid of it entirely and filled that void with more work or worrying about work. And that damages our relationship with God and causes us to disintegrate. God works, we work. God stopped. We need to stop. That stopping, that's what Sabbath is a gift. God stopped and enjoyed all that he had created. He enjoyed the order he had brought. We need to stop and enjoy what we're creating and enjoy each other. Sabbath isn't defined by what we can't do or don't do. It's defined by what it allows us to do. It allows us to stop working and spend time with God in gathered worship together. So if you're watching this from somewhere else and you're able to leave home next Sunday. Be here, gathered in worship. This gathering is a gift from God for us to be able to do this and spend time with one another. We try to encourage this by saying at 10 o'clock is community hour. Come gather. And this sanctuary is open for prayer during that time. Maybe pray with each other a little bit. What will God do if we begin to value that part of this day and really see it as a way of learning how to rest? It's gather and worship. It's spend time in God's word. Let God's word seep into me so that that faith begins to drizzle all the way through, so that my entire being is flavored by God and his word, where I'm building and I'm strengthening the connection between us and God and each other. That's what Sabbath is supposed to be, this gift. Perhaps there are places during the week where your work has sucked your faith out of you and you've started to feel it disintegrate and break apart. Stopping and resting allows us to reintegrate. And when we don't do this, our faith slowly but surely disintegrates, begins to break apart, get dry, and flake, and fall apart. Sometimes it happens subtly, sometimes you see it overtly and immediately. I think most of the time, you see it after months and years have gone by, and you realize, I am a shell of who I used to be. I'm a shell of the person of faith, the godly person I used to be. How did I disintegrate into this? It's because we're not taking this gift God has given us and called us to and using it to be reintegrated in faith. Sabbath rest gives us time, the time we need to reflect on life, time hardly anybody takes anymore, to ask questions like, where have I been? What have I done? Where am I going? What will I do? Who am I becoming? These are all crucial questions that we almost never stop and really ask of ourselves. They're always there. They sit there in the back of our mind. They sit there in the back of our psyche. And we feel the tension of them. But we're too busy to deal with that. Oh, I don't have time to think about such things. But by not thinking about them, we become aimless people. Our paths become crooked. And we're slowly falling apart as we walk them. And then one day we turn around and look like, what did my life become? And who am I now? Because we neglected this day, this gift of stopping. And instead now we have all this anxiety that's become just the undertone of our lives, always there, just sitting there. And you hear it, but you try to block it out with other noise. It's just anxiety because you know, this isn't really the life. You're not really thriving. You can mask it with successes, but you're not thriving at the calling God gave you. I watch our youth group. Now look at some of our young people who barely have enough time to breathe in their schedules. They fill their week with schoolwork, sports, clubs, and then they fill their weekends, including Sundays, with working because they have to have money. Why do they have to have money? Well, they got to afford their cell phone. Why do they need their cell phone? It's causing them to flip out and go crazy with all the other things going on. What do we need? What do we need? What is going on? I'm not trying to take your cell phones away. They're freaking out already. They're like hiding them. But what are we doing? What are we doing to the younger generation when we're teaching them every day, filled with work, every day filled with work because you have to do it, because you have to have this? What do we really have to have? Why are we rejecting and teaching our children to reject this gift of a day to stop and enjoy each other and enjoy God and not do everything and anything and work? Is anything worth them losing or never developing this kind of fully integrated faith that we need to thrive in this life and thrive at work? Because that's what's happening to them and it's what's happening to us. Our children are disintegrating in front of our eyes. Mental health, anxiety, all these disorders are increasing generation after generation because I would say one of the main reasons we're rejecting Jesus' invitation to come to him and find rest in him, to take up his rhythms of work, which include, yes, working, and working hard because you see it as an act of worship, but after you've worked hard, to stop and enjoy. Enjoy each other, enjoy God. Stop the working, stop the chores, stop all of it. A fully integrated life of faith is the only way to thrive at work and at school. You might think you're okay. You might think, oh, we're surviving. They're surviving. But you're not thriving. And listen to the wisdom of Proverbs on this. Proverbs 10:9 says, whoever walks with integrity walks securely. I'm not worried about what's happening around me. I'm walking securely because I'm walking with integrity. But whoever takes crooked paths may not show up right now, may not be obvious right now, but it will be found out. One day you'll realize, wow, that was not the way to have gone. These disintegrated paths might not appear to be a problem now, but they eventually show that they are. You might feel fine right now, your children might seem fine right now, but eventually the disintegration of their faith and our faith will lead us and them to emptiness that is crushing. And you'll wonder why, and God will say, you never accepted my gift of Sabbath. Worship team, would you just begin to make your way back up? The wonderful news in all this, with all of God's gifts, you may realize, oh my goodness, I've been neglecting this and not being godly. Yeah, worship team, come on. But in just a moment, God can turn you around and God can begin to transform you. So here's what I'd like to invite you all to do. Let's do a Daniel test. Remember the beginning, Daniel, when he first got to that new place and they're like, you're gonna do these things this way. And he's like, well, that kind of violates my relationship with God and my call to love God and love others. So how about we do a 10-day test? So here's what I'm gonna invite you all to do. A 10-Sunday test for all of us to try. 10 Sundays, and we'll see what difference it makes. 10 Sundays of stopping. 10 Sundays of using that day to enjoy God and enjoy others and celebrate life together. To stop and reflect on what you've done and where you've come and where you're going. And think about those bigger questions. 10 Sundays when you're not doing schoolwork and you're not doing work or chores, but instead you're enjoying life and loving one another. 10 Sundays of that. That'll get us through January. Think about that. Does it scare you to think about that? Does it sound impossible? Why is it impossible? Who are you a slave to that it makes that impossible? It's not impossible. What would it mean? What's it gonna look like in your life? What do you need to let go of? What do you need to add in? It's not just about the stuff you're gonna let go of. It's what are you gonna add in? Time with who? How are you gonna spend time reflecting? Are you gonna take up journaling? What are you gonna do that's gonna help this become this day every week, this full day every week of reintegrating? And you could do it the old Jewish way, which means it starts Saturday night at sundown and then ends at sundown on Sunday. That might be the best way to do it. However, or make it all day Sunday, however you're gonna do it, this day of rest. And let's just see what God does. I'm gonna throw this Daniel challenge out to us. Let's try it and see what God will do. Would you stand with me this morning? The first step, I think, right now is to just come to God and say, Lord, I confess. I've been neglecting rest. My work has become something other than me living out my calling for you to love God and love others. And so this morning, let's find rest in Jesus. This is not a message aimed at trying to make you feel guilty about how you're living your life. I'm trying to hold out to all of us a different way of living where we'll actually thrive the way God intended us, and we'll actually live godly lives in this world. That'll change this world. And Jesus calls us to stop and rest, so can we just do that? Forget about what's next. Let's just stop and rest. Without him, we fall apart. We disintegrate. We need you, Jesus, right now to guard our hearts, to guide our hearts, to hold us together, to give us rest.